Well, I'm not even a lawyer. And so when I read the program on which I was to take part, I noticed the frightening title, Is There Still a Constitution? Not knowing where to turn and understanding that the Philadelphia Society really is the Chicago Society, I called Joe Morris and said, what have you lawyers done to the Constitution? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I have a panel here. Is there still a Constitution? Has something happened to it? He said, I have another call coming in. Let me put you on hold. I was on hold, and I noticed there was some music in the background, and I slowly discerned it was Abide With Me, which seemed a little alarming. And finally, after 5 minutes of Abide With Me, a series of dots began to appear, little beeps, which I thought were sort of routine until I noticed they spelled S-O-S. So I gathered from that that the response was that it's either rudimentary or ineffable, and you figure it out. Is there still a Constitution? During the time of waiting, I was reminded that those of you who are not lawyers and maybe economists will be pleased to know the discovery that Columbus turns out to have been the first economic consultant. It seems that when he set out, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was, and he did it all at government expense, which is, after all, the way to go. In pondering the ineffability of my task as a non-lawyer to try to make some sense of our question, I was reminded of a story that, under similar circumstances, I'm sure, Harry Truman told, of the man who woke up in a casket, and he looked about, and he said to himself, if I'm alive, what am I doing in here holding this lily? And if I'm dead, why do I need to go to the bathroom? This then gives rise to a sort of a physiological theory of the Constitution. Perhaps not a full-blown organic theory of state, but nonetheless, it has been contended by jurisprudence that what the Constitution means is not only what the Supreme Court says it means, but that it's a sort of byproduct of the alimentary canal. We've always thought more of the Constitution than that, and particularly political scientists. We couldn't admit that the Constitution wasn't there. We would definitely be out of business. The lawyers obviously can practice on. So in approaching our subject, we have a society, rather ironically, which is one of the most litigious in the history of mankind. Not that this is new. In reading Sir John Fortescue, he complains about the English in the 1460s as being terribly litigious. Apparently, it's an old practice. But nonetheless, we have an elaborate institutional order which is founded on something that we think is the Constitution, or thought was until our panel began a few moments ago. It was the Constitution. We have the 104th Congress sitting as we speak. We have a resident, not to say more, in the White House. We have upwards of 600 volumes of federal reports being churned out that in various ways elucidate, argue against the meaning of the Constitution, which amounts to a huge literary and intellectual investment, all paying lip service, if not more, to the Constitution of the United States. Now, my concern about whether we have a constitution or not is perhaps more profound. I'm worried that we might not have a country. This is more serious. It seems to me that in terms of considering the relationship and the realities of governance in our society, the great challenge has to come in terms of the erosion of what I would call civic consciousness. For the past several years, a number of us have been paying a lot of fascinating and fascinated attention to the plight of the former Iron Curtain countries of Central Europe and of Eastern Europe, which had come into their own as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Here were countries, after all, who truly did not have constitutions. In the case of the Czech Republic, formerly Czechoslovakia, there was no constitution when we first began going there, literally. Since 1993, there has been a constitution, the constitution resulting in part from the division of the country between Czech Republic and Slovakia. So here, after all, were countries that had no constitutions, were unacquainted in terms of the praxis of the society with the practice of free government, which lacked, therefore, something which is the sort of cushion and mainspring for a vital free governmental system on analysis, which has various names, the one most frequently invoked being a civil society, which I find somewhat objectionable, since there's a difference between the civil society in Hegel and the civil society that one encounters in the writings of our founders, growing out of Adam Ferguson and the Scottish Common Sense School. So civil society is a term to be conjured with. It sort of means a realm of freedom from the standpoint of the Hegelians and Marxists. So civic consciousness is a question. That is to say, the preparation of a society to engage in self-government on the basis of a consensus about what it is to be a human being, what it is a relationship between humans as humans, what our citizenship responsibilities, what it is that a government can rightly aspire to do, and what the limits might be on government that we identify as being the heart, as the previous speakers have emphasized, the heart of constitutionalism, namely that there are limits on the powers of government and that the limits can be enforced by established procedures. Now, in our own society, it's not a question that we never had this. The question is that it seems to me to be in crisis. It's in crisis from a variety of perspectives. The one strand that I would identify is from the standpoint of ideological assault. The whatever happened in 1937 in terms of the switch in time that saved nine in the court packing case, it seems past dispute that for the past half century, and with increasing earnestness since the collapse of the Soviet Empire, there has been an attack on the fundamental beliefs of upon which our own society rests from the standpoint of a concerted ideological perspective that culminates in Nietzschean nihilism. This is not only antithetical to our self-governing institutions, but it's antithetical to everything that George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and the other luminaries of the American founding took to be true and deserving of protection in the name of liberty, in the name of human existence itself. In other words, our founding was not ideological. We've become ideological ourselves by embracing conservatism as a cause per se, by embracing liberalism, by speaking in ideological terms, which even 25 years ago were rarely invoked as a matter of common discourse. But the founding was not ideological in the pregnant sense by which, and from a perspective that I think now we are in fact endangered, in that the founders of this country did not imagine that it was possible for them, through their own agency, to transform the world, a mark of ideological thought. There was not a veneration of something called autonomous man. There was the understanding that there was a creaturely relationship that we've heard spoken of at the first panel and again and a few moments ago between man and his maker. And this triggers by that slender thread in the Declaration of Independence an appeal to the divine ground of being, which was of great consequence at the time, and it seems to me is still of a great consequence. The the founding, with apologies to Gordon Wood, was not utopian. There was no utopianism involved, unless you want to confuse Christian eschatological expectations of the second coming of Christ with utopianism, and that's not utopianism. It was not radically secular, as we've said. It was not based on a counterfactual second reality, that if you can imagine and describe it with sufficient intensity, you can somehow transform yourself and the world in the same moment, if only you have enough will or revolutionary backing to do it, a revolution to end all revolutions. There was no prohibition against the asking of questions, which is the hallmark of all ideological thought. There was talk of truth this morning. The very last thing that anybody who wishes to guard against an exploration of truth will embrace is the principle that that is an irrelevant question. The Marxian, denke nicht, frage mich nicht, don't think, don't ask me. True socialists who are rational don't ask questions of that kind. And the question that's being asked is a question of the ground of being, the fundamental question, not just how did the Cubs do yesterday or something like that. See, it was not deformative and obscuring of reality. Ideological thought forms as a means of not illuminating and making intelligible and interpreting and giving a persuasive account, but rather of obscuring and making the reality as it truly is something that is less than the whole reality, upon which then this sort of intellectual enterprise can proceed. But rather there was an aim at justice and truth. In as modest a metaphysical document as the Federalist Number 51, you've got James Madison reminding everyone that justice is the end of civil government, that it will ever be pursued until it either be attained or until liberty be lost in the pursuit. So this then is a suggestion of the contrast between the consciousness in the period of the American founding and the kind of commonplace consciousness that we presently see ourselves like osmosis absorbing through the ordinary discourse of an ideologically charged intellectual world. Now, the positive aspects of the American founding could concern us at great length, and great length we don't have. But my point would be that the American founding is an episode in the history of liberty which reaches into the medieval period and back to antiquity. It is not the first act of modernity. It is the last act of the Renaissance, as one scholar has phrased it. There's a lot about the American founding, which is not attributable to the latest wave from the Enlightenment. In fact, it was protected against that. It was heavily indebted to principles of rule of law, as old as Magna Carta. The phrase itself, a government of laws, being one coined in Aristotle's Politics in the third book in the 16th chapter, as you know, and adopted by John Adams for the 1780 Constitution of Massachusetts, and into Marbury versus Madison in 1803, and thus into constitutional law. But constitutionalism, a coinage apparently of the American founding period, nobody sees that it appeared before that, and religious belief, which strengthens this slender reed of the relationship between the creation and the creator in ways which were of incalculable importance during the period of the Revolution. Without James Otis's Black Regiment, the Revolution probably never could have come off. As Perry Miller said, a cool rationalism such as Jefferson's might have declared the independence of such folk, but could never have persuaded them to fight for it. This strand of understanding, which was absolutely bedrock, and without which our founding is completely unintelligible, the understanding of liberty, not as a abstract principle in the sense of life, liberty, and fraternity, or death. The notion of liberty is the ocean of liberty, as he said in his great conciliation speech of March 1775. And our tradition attaches to concrete things. It is specific and concrete. There is no such thing as abstract liberty. And in our debates in constitutional matters, it is always attached to the power of taxing. Your freedom to hold property, your freedom to enjoy the benefit of your labor, the freedom to live as free men, the liber homo, which appears and shows up in the first draft of the Magna Carta, 1215, which is repeated then in 1225, when Magna Carta then at the end of the 13th century becomes the first statute of England. That free man is the man that we have in question. What then was a free man from the standpoint of the 13th century? It always seemed to me to be an interesting question. And one answer is, a free man is one who can tell the magistrate to his face what he thinks of him. That's a free man. Now, we inherited that tradition. Our tradition is rooted in classical antiquity. It's rooted in Christianity from the Middle Ages through the Reformation into the events in America. And it is that, it seems to me, which is probably the unavoidable and essential attribute of a civic consciousness, the source of a civic consciousness essential to free government under the kind of constitution that was drafted and ratified at the time of the American founding, and to which we continue to pay homage and due. After all, we constantly check ourselves against the thought of the founders. Please note there's a cult of the Constitution that goes on in this country. However many deviations from it we can all find, and how many aberrations we can see in various cases decided by this court and that court, including the Supreme Court, that we dislike and find fault with. But nonetheless, the Constitution is part of the history of liberty, and the history of liberty will not die as long as there are free men. Thank you.